All right, should we get started? I guess the sooner we start, the sooner we finish, right? So welcome. Thank you so much, Antonia, for the kind invitation to come present to you guys, you graduating semester master's students, to talk about publishing and nursing, a topic that's near and dear to my heart. I've met some of you. Actually, I've worked with some of you. But if you don't know me, my name is Sean Clark, and I've been a professor here at the Ingram School since July of 2013. No, 2012. 2012. The memory is fading out. And I've been involved. I actually did my master's and my PhD education here at McGill. Went away for a while. Went to the University of Pennsylvania, the University of Toronto. Have the honor of being back here. Along the way, I've been involved in journal publishing in a number of capacities. In fact, when I was finishing out my graduate studies here, I joined the Canadian Journal of Nursing Research, which we call CJNR now, as an editorial assistant. And then along the way of my career as a professor, I became an associate editor at CJNR. And last year, Dr. Lori Gottlieb finished a 20-year term as editor, during which she did marvelous things, but I took over as editor. And she's off teaching in another course at the moment, so I have the honor of being here to talk with you this morning. I want it to be interactive. I am here for you guys, really, to give you a little bit of a personal introduction to the nuts and bolts of publishing, which can be a little bit mysterious, can feel like it's kind of cloaked in a lot of traditions and little secrets. If you don't follow them, your article won't get published and so forth. To talk about those, but I'd love to answer questions that you might have. And I'd love if there were things that have come up, because you guys have been immersed, saturated, marinating in the literature now throughout your whole master's program. You've read more articles than probably you ever imagined possible. If you have questions about the journal publishing, publishing in general, and about journals specifically and how they work, I would love to answer those kinds of questions. I've been involved with CJNR. I also served for 5 years as a deputy editor, meaning a handling editor for a health services research journal called Medical Care, which is one of the official journals of the American Public Health Association. So I've seen nursing, and I've been on the editorial board in American Journal of Nursing, Nursing Management, a bunch of journals. So I've seen a bunch of things. I'm going to talk primarily about research journal articles today, but I can answer questions about anything, and you will quickly see that I'll address any questions that you happen to want to ask, whether they seem immediately pertinent or not. Does that sound all right? Okay. So today's topics, there we go. I want to talk briefly about the difference between an article and a student paper, because this is the transition that you're going to right now. As of May, June, you're going to be moving to the zone where you're no longer submitting papers for a course professor, but you're trying to get into the published literature. So I want to draw that contrast out, because that making that leap is often challenging for folks at first, until they start to understand the fundamental differences between the two. I want to talk about why we write for publication. I want to talk about the stages of the writing process, a little bit about writing with other people, because in all likelihood, especially as you move towards bringing your 632 projects into print, you're going to be working with perhaps your fellow students who were on the project with you, as well as your clinical supervisor and your faculty supervisor. But this advice will be good for whatever you do, because in the future, in all likelihood, you will be publishing, writing and publishing with others. We'll talk about finding the right publication type for you. We're going to, like I said, we're going to mostly talk about research journal articles. As you know, when you were getting feedback on your literature review, if you provided too many things that weren't research journal articles, you got feedback that you needed more of those. But we need to talk about some of the other kinds, just as a point of reference. And then I'm going to talk about peer review, which is this mysterious process that people are a little fearful about, a little upset about sometimes, especially when they had their first contact with it. But maybe for those of you who haven't published already, I can demystify it a little. And we'll talk about a little bit of the process involved, as well as how peer review works. I will give you an inside view in the mentality of a peer reviewer, so you can anticipate what kind of comments you're going to get back and what the motivations will be, because there's nothing more distressing than being shocked, feeling blindsided about why peer reviewers are giving you certain kinds of messages back about your work. And then we'll talk a little bit about the publication process and where things are going in journal publishing. When I started as a graduate student here in, and I'm going to embarrass myself, 1989, I spent a lot of time, there was a library here in Wilson Hall, which some of you probably know about, right? And I spent a lot of time in front of the photocopying machine with paper journals and bound journals, photocopying. We don't do that so much anymore. And there's some great stuff about it, but there's stuff that you probably should know about where that future is going, and there's things that I don't even know about where it's going, even though I keep fairly close tabs on where the industry is. And I want to tell you a little bit about CJNR specifically, so that you can park this for future reference, and we can field questions along the way. So just please ask, because really, I'm here for you guys. Okay. So, first topic, the difference between a student paper and a journal article. And for me, it's all encapsulated in what the purpose is. When you write a paper for a course, the primary purpose is to demonstrate to your instructor that you have met the objectives in the course as operationalized in the rubric and the guidelines. And often, you will be writing from the beginning. You'll be writing about a topic that your instructor may not be an expert about, or they may know lots of things about, but they want to make sure that you know about things from the beginning. And you will be very thorough, usually, in laying out literature, methods, considerations, and so forth. And you will reference externally. I don't know if you ever remember being asked for, what's the reference behind this statement? And it's something really obvious, like disease X is really, you know, takes a huge toll on patients and families, and they ask for a reference for it. But you'll provide references, extensive lists of references. And in fact, that's often what will impress your instructor on top of having done a good job of the assignment. On the contrasting side, a journal article is about contributing to an ongoing scholarly debate or informing fellow professionals. So it's not about impressing your instructor or your professor. It's about having something to say. The space considerations, and I know you're always grappling with page limits. You know, how many words or how many pages, double-spaced, can I get away with things by changing the font, by altering the margins just a little bit, and I'll come within range, and so forth. But the space considerations, even in the electronic age, where we're not talking about making hundreds or thousands of copies of a journal, mailing them around the world, and so forth, but even in the internet era, where with electronics, where you'd think a page or so didn't matter, but there are copy editing costs, typesetting costs, and so forth, space considerations in journals and reader preferences, frankly, because readers don't have time to read everything they like, they allow you, but they require you to make assumptions so that you're not starting from the beginning. So instead of your primary audience for a student paper is your instructor, your primary audience for a journal article is the field, the broader field of your peers and fellow researchers in an area. So we summarize or streamline the literature and the method sections, and the discussion is usually quite concise. So the literature, we're not going way back to the beginning. We're making some assumptions that somebody who reads the title of the article will know a thing or two about what chronic obstructive pulmonary disease is, or why nursing education is important, or why, you know, the fundamental reason to be interested in a topic. They will not expect you to go back to the beginning of time about how a particular question has been answered. They'll expect you to zoom in on what areas of the literature you need to know about in order to make sense of your article and understand how you came up with your research question. The method section, whereas for a thesis or a project or a dissertation, you want all of the details laid out. Your thesis committee or your advisory committee will want all of the details. Here, they'll want it streamlined. They'll take some things for granted. I mean, we still ask, for instance, for there to be a statement in most journals that research ethics clearance was obtained at the relevant organizations. But that's one sentence, not the paragraph or the pages that you had to write in your original proposal and your thesis or your project. And referencing is a lot more selective, to the point that there will often be a maximum number of references that you're allowed to include. And some guidelines about what year limits and so forth you should use when thinking about what to include if a reference isn't a classic one. So, fundamentally different process. I can tell you, having been a journal editor for a while and reviewed a lot. So when I talk about the psychology of a peer reviewer, think of me when you're submitting and getting back peer review, because I probably have reviewed close to, well, in the high hundreds, if not in the thousands of articles in my career so far. So I'm the guy who's reading your stuff, who's looking for the gem in there, who's looking to give you some concrete feedback. I can tell you that there are giveaway telltale signs of an article that is a converted student paper. One of them is really extensive referencing. Another one is going way back to the beginning and assuming absolutely nothing about the reader's knowledge. A very disproportionate amount, like, you know, half the manuscript devoted to the lit review. That's another giveaway. Because unlike your instructors who want to see everything that came before, most of your professional readers are going to want to know what you found in your study. All of these things, they can be giveaways. And I can probably find, and it's such a common phenomenon that people have to work so hard to convert their student papers into peer-reviewed articles, that there's actually been articles about avoiding student paper syndrome. That's the way they've written the articles. So I can link you up with some interesting things around that. So the upshot. Transforming a research project course paper or write-up of a master's project or other graduate research project like a thesis or a dissertation into a publishable manuscript requires time, because there was a different purpose, energy, some focus, understanding what a peer-reviewed journal wants, and an understanding of the differences in formats. And I can't emphasize this more. Okay, so why publish? So it's not to become famous, at least not immediately, right? And it's not to get rich, at least not immediately. It's really about sharing information with colleagues. It's about trying to improve patient care by informing others. It's about enhancing your own knowledge, because just like when you teach something, you have something that you've known about for forever, and you go and you try and teach somebody about that, you have to go back to the foundations, revisit your assumptions, think about the sequencing of ideas, and you learn things yourself by doing that thinking and doing that researching. Writing journal articles enhances your own knowledge. There are a lot of folks who say that it's really critical in nursing, given the amount of implicit knowledge we all hold on to but don't necessarily document. It's really important that we think about the various ways that we can put down those thoughts in paper, help others in the profession jump on, piggyback on, extend things. And it's also about advancing your career, let's be blunt. Because everyone knows that when you put in a fellowship or a scholarship application, when you have publications to put on a list, it's better to have some publications than none. But I want you not to get too obsessed about the advancing the career element. We'll come back to that, and we'll come back to the pressures around publishing, which you're not quite into yet, but some of you I know, and I know I'm not going to ask any of you to admit to it, but some of you probably have aspirations of maybe doing other degrees, maybe a PhD, maybe becoming researchers. One of the things that people who are giving out scholarships for PhDs, fellowships, one of the things they're looking for, did this person in the past, did they make use of research they did as an undergrad, as a master's student? Did they contribute back to the literature? Can they get a cycle that I'm going to talk about going, where they have an idea, they make the idea real, they get some data, they put it into the literature, and then they pursue in a cycle? Can they complete all the portions of the scholarly inquiry process? So that cycle. People have research ideas. Sometimes they go out and they seek research funding, or at least approval to conduct research in a given setting. They conduct projects, and then they disseminate them. They put the knowledge out, and often that whole process of dissemination points out where new study is necessary, further research is needed in a particular area, and the cycle turns again. And in the world of, you know, sort of CVs and professional advancement, the things that really count are the things in the red boxes. the research funding, which you don't necessarily have to worry about quite yet, getting people to vet your research ideas and tell you that they're important enough that they're willing to invest some money in them. But this dissemination piece becomes very important. And for people who will invest in your training, in your projects in the future, they want to know that when you get a research idea, you can turn the wheel and come back and put some things out in the literature that are demonstrated proof that you did the project. Now, I know you probably heard discussions about knowledge translation and how the journal article and the poster and the podium presentation maybe are not the best ways always to put information in the hands of clinicians who can use the information. We'll call dissemination in the broad sense, not just journal articles, but everything. But I can tell you, the things that really count in the end, dissemination, if you are trying to establish a track record, and funding and outside funding to do your work. The most important thing, if you haven't picked this up already, because I tend to do this, I hammer the same point over and over again different ways. You're getting into a conversation to raise understanding of a phenomenon to improve practice. It's all about communication. When, as a peer reviewer, I get an article and I feel as if, and I'm making a joke here, maybe it's not a funny joke, the purpose of this article is to, you know, explain the experience of patients experiencing whatever, I'm thinking, okay, good. Okay, I'm expecting to read something about patient experience or nurse experience or manager's experience. When it's very, very vague what it is, I get the sense that the purpose of this article is that I need to publish something because my master's supervisor told me I should, or my boss tells me that for my next performance review I need a publication on my CV. It may be. I mean, there's those dual processes, the contributing to the discourse and the career advancement. But for the journal editor, for the peer reviewer, they care about message. So never, never, never forget that. Keep that foremost in your mind. What am I trying to tell the world about whatever I'm putting out there? Okay. So the two questions you know the answer to, in theory, before you start a researcher, I like the party metaphor. Who's already at the party when it comes to discussing a phenomenon, whether you're talking about infections after cardiac surgery, whether you're talking about nurses learning to do evidence-based practice in the real world, whether you're talking about the experiences of moms and babies and dads in maternal child settings, oncology patients or whatever? You have done a lit review and you already know who's at the party in the room and what they're saying and what they're doing and what questions interest them and how they align in terms of their understanding of how phenomena work. And you have a sense also of what interests them. Because of all of the sea of things that you could know about oncology patients or evidence-based practice or whatever, there are some questions that are probably more interesting than others. The one question that you need to answer, and you can only have once you've actually done your research, is what do you have to add to this conversation? If you come into the party, who do you go stand beside? Or what do you have to say to the different clusters of people who are doing different kinds of work or are thinking about your phenomenon in different ways? So that business about dialogue, I would impress that upon you. So the reason to do the lit review is to understand how people are talking about an issue, to figure out where you're going to jump in, and then as you are about to jump in, you should probably think about what you have to say. So finding the ideas, those ideas and messages about what's important, one of the things that's built into a sequence like 630, 631, 632, what's built into the dissertation, the thesis and dissertation writing process, is presenting your ideas as they evolve. And those messages, or those take-homes, if you want, get increasingly clear, and it's an excellent way. All of those presentations, getting the presentations ready and getting the feedback, excellent way to get ready for writing a paper, because you get reactions from people about what they thought was interesting about what you said and what makes sense. And you can draw the connections between what was already done, what's really of interest now, what your data had to say, where things were expected, where things were not expected, and so forth. So it gets you thinking to present, gets you thinking about your audience, and it may, and in the case of your classroom, it's your instructors and your fellow students, but eventually it's going to be an anonymous set of peer reviewers, and in the long run, it's going to be hundreds, if not thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who will read your great work. So the tough part sometimes is coming up with the exact ideas behind a paper or presentation, distilling things down. And it's, you know, some people argue that to do a 5-minute presentation is a lot tougher than to do a half an hour presentation, because you have to cut, and go down to the limited number of messages that you can effectively deliver. And it's tempting to throw in more and more and more, but you can't develop them well in a short period of time. You go beyond the space that you've been allocated, and you get the hook. And in peer-reviewed literature, it's about running out of space to write your ideas up. The tough part is sometimes coming up with those ideas. And what you start out with, thinking the results are going to be, or the directions of your article are going to be, when you start out a project and have done the lit review, is not always what the final paper will emphasize or bring out. That's an important thing to realize. In a school paper, this is something I probably should have mentioned before, in the school paper, the process of how you got to your question, how you started with the lit review, came upon the question, chose a design, did all of this, came up with the results, and how it was relatively linear, that's a very important thing. You know, sort of documenting your work as you go along. The average reader of the peer-reviewed literature, including the reviewers themselves, they don't really care how you got there. They want a message. They want something interesting. And if the message that you thought you were going to speak to doesn't turn out to be the one that your data are best equipped to handle, well, they'd like you to sort of smooth out some of the edges and rearrange things so that you do tell a coherent story. That can require some creativity. That can require standing back after dwelling with things for a while. The good part is that although it can require some time and creative thinking to come up with a good message that contributes to the dialogue, the actual sequencing of material in a paper, especially a research paper, that doesn't require much creative thinking. You know, you have to have, there are formulas that are involved. You know, sort of the classic IMRAD, introduction, methods, results, and discussion. That format. And what goes in? I mean, some journals may like to see sample first, some journals may like to see something else first, but basically there are specific things that you have to tick off, that you have to write about. And once you get going, it doesn't suffer from the same issue that you see in creative writing sometimes, where you just don't know as you go along where it's going to come to. But once you have your ideas, you basically have a tick list to complete. And those formulas, some people argue, especially in qualitative research, can be a little constraining in terms of having to write sentences around each of a whole bunch of subheadings. But those formulas actually help not only you, but they help the reader know what they can expect to understand about what you did and how you did it and so forth. So there are specific challenges in writing articles, but they're manageable. There are always lessons to be learned from every study. That's one thing that you probably should know, that you should probably, you probably realize already, that you may come to a qualitative study that you've done, a quantitative study. You may have seen what everybody else saw before you, even though you thought you were sort of going to carve out some new ground. Or something may have gone really off track in terms of how your data collection went, and you wound up doing something very, very different. And so the conclusions that you can draw regarding your primary research questions, maybe you don't feel as comfortable as you were hoping for. That's okay, though. The best case scenario is that everything goes in a straight line. It's like in life, right? You know, you want everything to go in a straight line. You know, you have your plan in mind, you go for it, there's no detours. But sometimes there's detours, but there's always things that you've learned from the experience of doing a study. And I would venture that pretty much every single project that's going on right now in 632 has a paper in it. It just might not be the paper you would have originally thought when you started 630. And it's just that's an important thing to keep in mind. And that process of sorting through what the message might be, it's not that you have to do it all by yourself, you know, because you can get help with that. You can get help. Already I've built in a clinical person and a faculty member, sometimes both. There's help from people like me. You know, I would be willing to talk with you about finding a message and things. You can find, there's lots of people out in the field who would, especially if they actually work in a given area of the literature, will help you find what that message is. So do not despair. So I'm, you know, message number one, message is everything. Message the lesson number two, there's a message or there's a lesson in every single one of your projects to be drawn out. You just have to be ready to work a little sometimes when things have gone differently. Let's talk about authorship, and I'm going to come back to this afterwards. What is an author? And I mean, the superficial answer can be the author is the woman or man who gets to take credit for the article. And that's part of it. It's about credit, but it's about other things too. So this is a definition that comes from Elsevier, which is a big multinational company that publishes thousands of journals and textbooks and so forth. And they start out with the somewhat unsettling premise that authorship is not a clearly defined concept. It's actually one of these socially constructed ideas. You wouldn't think, right? Because you spend all these hours in front of your word processor writing documents, and no, it's not so fuzzy, it's not so socially constructed. It's about all these hours that I spend writing all of this text and revising it over and over again. To be an author, one must have responsibility for a particular aspect, not a minimal one, of the research or preparation of the work. That is, you must have made a significant contribution to, and here's the list, conception, design, execution, or interpretation of the reported study, and you must have approved the final form of the work. And fundamentally, and this is an interesting one, an author must be prepared and have the ability and responsibility to publicly defend the work. So this is an interesting business. I can tell you when I started in all of this business as a graduate student 20 years ago, people were starting to talk about this. The discussion has got a lot more robust and mature now, I would say, that people are really thinking about what this means. One of the things that they realize, that we realize now is solo authored research is quite uncommon. Solo authored essays, opinion papers, and so forth, perhaps more common, but research as research. When you're a student, you're often working with clinicians and more experienced folks in terms of research to get a project off the ground and to pursue it. When you're actually a working researcher and out of your training programs, you're often putting together teams of people with the right subject matter, area expertise, and methods expertise. Research is mostly done on teams. So the question is, when a team comes together to do a project and to work on research, who gets to take credit for what's going on? And we're going to talk a little more in the presentation about how that goes. But I just wanted to introduce the idea now. But basically, to be an author, you have to be, you should have been involved in the heart of what went on in the study. There are people who may appear as authors who haven't done each and every one of these things. Somebody's got to stand up for that paper, though. When the peer reviewers see it and when it goes into print and somebody questions, hey, did you actually really do those interviews? Could you produce a transcript for us of what that actually said? Because I don't believe anybody actually said that. Or, you know, I think a mistake was made here and I think you might have plagiarized somebody else's work. Somebody has to be able to stand up for this paper and say, no. It was done right. It was done properly. This was part of a process, and we were a team that did it, but we are willing as a team to stand up for it. So where things get fuzzy is what constitutes meaningful contributions sometimes. And it gets complicated as well. I don't know if we want to get too far off the track around this, but in the past, there has been sort of an opinion out there that if you were a clinician out in the field and you provided access to your patients, that even if you weren't involved in generating the hypotheses behind a study, weren't involved in doing the data collection or the analysis, that you had the right to be an author. Some of our sisters and brothers in medicine have felt this way historically, that there's been a little bit of... But in nursing, what we're seeing is that sometimes there are clinicians and managers now who may not have been deeply, deeply involved in a piece of research, but they're saying, I'm letting you in. My bosses are sort of on my backs to publish more. I need to be an author on your papers, even if I wasn't involved in generating the hypotheses and so forth. I don't know if you've ever seen anything like this before. I'm not going to ask you any direct questions around this. But this is the reality. There are also issues that come up about who comes first in an authorship line, and what that should mean, and how people who might not know you, might not know the study you did, but will see your CV or see other people's CVs or resumes, and will look at where you fit on the author line, and will draw conclusions about what role you really played in carrying out a research study. Some of the issues, you know, if there are three people in a group working on a 632 project and somebody is publishing, there must be first, you know, there must be a first author somehow, because you can't necessarily stack everybody up together, but you can put a little asterisk and you can say, in some journals you can say the contributions of the first three articles were equal, they were just, the order was decided upon by random, by random number selection, or by alphabetical order or whatever. But there has to be a discussion about how all of this goes. And some of these questions come down to the competition around who comes first and so forth, and who controls the resources to do research and to succeed professionally and scientifically. And sometimes it's about feelings of entitlement. Now, what did I say before message number one in this presentation was? It's about the contribution to the dialogue and the literature and what you have to contribute to an ongoing dialogue. But we can't pretend that this isn't some of what's going on when it comes time to do the work necessary to publish. And let's face it, after 632 ends, and you've submitted, and you've gotten your wonderful grades and so forth, there will be extra work that's required to transform those projects into papers. And one of the topics that's going to have to be resolved somewhere along the line, if it hasn't come up already, and I know some of your supervisors have talked to you already about what they're assuming will be authorship, what they're assuming is going to happen with respect to the materials that you collected. But they're also talking about, you know, if there are papers that get written or when there are papers that get written, what authorship order will be. But some of you haven't had those conversations yet, and so you probably should be thinking about this. The biggest dilemmas around authorship, being totally frank, and I'm sort of going back and transporting myself 25 years ago into your position, the biggest dilemmas are often faced by junior researchers, and I know some of you have published already, so I'm not trying to spread with one brush, cover everybody, and faculty, people who are really worried about how many lines they have on their CV with publications and where they fit on the author line and so forth. Now, the interesting thing is, if you decide that you're going to do research, you like it, you got the bug, and you want to keep publishing, after 3, 4, 5 years, after you've been publishing regularly, and it's not a big deal anymore, and you're no longer terrified when you see in your email box results of peer review for article number, whatever, that's based, and you know, hey, I know how to do this. There are unexpected things, but I can publish and I'm going to have enough publications to do my thing. Once you get to a point where there's a critical mass of publications, it's basically clear if somebody is doing that wheel in an effective way, is carrying out a series of research projects, and it plays nicely with others, because if you don't play nicely around authorship, nobody wants to work with you anymore. But at the beginning, it's a little bit scary. And folks are, understandably, a little leery of putting in lots of effort that doesn't come back to them. And I'm just putting it out there. Norms differ across fields and institution regarding what's sufficient grounds for authorship. In some places, like I said, the understanding is that if you are a clinician and you are involved in giving access to a unit or to a population, that that's sufficient grounds for authorship. That's the way historically it used to work in medicine. There are departments where the department head gets to be an author, a named author on every single paper that comes out of the department. That is not the case at McGill. But, you know, again, you got to sort of know what's out there. In most cases, people, I mean, I would say from what I've seen at McGill, what I've seen in the other universities, Pennsylvania and Toronto that I've worked at, it's basically what I was talking about on that first slide. Who has contributed the most towards conception, development, you know, data collection, analysis, and write-up, and has everybody contributed towards the final form of the manuscript? What drives authorship order? In the social sciences, humanities, and to the extent that, and education, and to the extent that nursing borrows from that, first author is most important in the declining and afterwards. That's the understanding is that each person further down the line has contributed less, unless unless there is some sort of note that the first three authors contributed equally or whatever. But when the published article shows up in PubMed or whatever, people won't necessarily see that, and they'll see the author that comes first. And if you know from your APA, if there are six or more authors, it becomes Joe Bloggs et al. And all the other people that are second or beyond, they don't show up, and then somebody actually has to go fish out the article to realize that people participated. You may know that in medicine, the one that's the prestigious slot is in lab science, the last author is the prestigious one. They're the most established person, and they were the ones that were probably very key to the development of the study, and the first author is conceded to the student, or is given to the student who did that development, who is expected to write the paper, but the intellectual driving force is in the last position. It's an interesting thing just to know about. I would say in nursing we borrow a little from the two traditions, but I can tell you, in general, for these master's projects, you will be one of the first authors for sure, because you have played a key role. You may in fact be the first author, but there may be circumstances when the conception of the study was primarily driven by your supervisor, and they heavily guided all of the phases. And you'll write more collaboratively together, and the researcher herself, she needs to make sure that she has clear intellectual claim and first authorship, and she may say, I need first author on this, I will write the first draft of the manuscript. One principle that I've liked that's worked well for me for about 20 years is the idea that the first author is the one who comes up with the complete first draft, however rough and sketchy it is. That actually gets us out the door, because sometimes nobody gets around to actually, 632 is over, graduation is coming up, and you know, you're finally relieved no longer to have to write other papers and so forth, and you say, I'm going to let out a deep breath and I'm going to go live my life for a little while. And meanwhile, that material sits on the shelf and starts to get old and moldy, and nobody wants to go back to it. So sometimes, you know, the deal is, okay, you know, first person, she who writes the first draft becomes first author. I know that there, in your course materials, Margaret Purden was telling me in our little exchange, that there's a principle now that after June, the supervisor has the right to take the materials and work, you know, and start to develop them if the student hasn't made moves towards starting to publish from them. An interesting thing. So, putting it out there. Any questions so far? I mean, I've thrown a lot of stuff at you. Is this... So who's published something? Like, who's published in peer reviews? Okay, great, okay. And was it a research paper?
Yeah.
Okay. And where were you on the author line, just out of curiosity?
Second,
okay. Okay, and your supervisor was first?
No, actually he was last, because it was more in the biomedical field.
Okay. Outside the peer review literature, has anybody sort of published in newsletters or editorials, opinion pieces, or anything? No. Okay. So this is relatively new. Have you ever felt that there was some pressure to have publications on your resume or your CV? Have you ever felt that? Okay. Yeah, because in the biomedical sciences especially, that business of the cycle is really, really, really important. A supervisor, a leader of a lab or director of a program who isn't publishing regularly, whose students don't produce, very soon they don't get any more scholarships and fellowships. They won't get any more money to do their ongoing program, and the money dries up very quickly, and with the money, the research dries up, and so that cycle. In nursing, we have slightly different traditions. We can talk about that and how things are evolving in that way, but it's a little bit different. Okay. Have you heard discussions about authorship? Have you heard about conflicts that people have run into around authorship? Yeah, that there's misunderstanding sometimes. It's an area where there's so much possibility of misunderstandings. The advice that I was given, and you know, that people who are writing, you know, 10 tips for the new researcher or for the graduate student, negotiate authorship order up front with every single project you do, which is great in theory. But sometimes you are the junior person who's starting out, And you are just trying to get your toe in the door. And frankly, there's a lot of unpredictable things about how the project's going to go, what papers are going to come out of it. And frankly, you don't feel in a position to have a discussion with big deal researcher X about how all of this is going to go. And the thing is, I mean, even with experienced researchers, even with people who have been publishing for decades, some issues come up. So if you feel sort of twinges of anxiety and so forth, it's not you, it's the nature of the beast. But like I said, what you have to remember, when it comes to the journals themselves, they care about the quality of the articles, they care about the messages, and what you really want to care about is, are you helping with the ongoing development of the discipline? Okay. Writing with others, what is the first barrier? And I sort of alluded to it a little while ago. What I would call failure to launch. We got this great paper and we want to get it out. But somehow or other, with all of the things going on at work and with your professional life, that first draft of the manuscript never gets written. Time crunches, conflicting commitments. And really, the only way to fix this is to decide that getting that manuscript together and getting that first draft together, you make a commitment, you set some flexible deadlines, and I can always guarantee that those deadlines will have to be moved, and to try your best to stick to them. And that's why I think over time, the course outline in 632 has evolved to the point where they're saying, you know what? We understand you lead pressured lives, everybody leads pressured lives, but we want to get papers out the door and we want to have an understanding that we're going to try our best to get these things out and we need some rough parameters around moving that forward. Sometimes, as you know, when you join a research group, even in 630, 631, 632, you're joining a research group that's already doing stuff, that has a program in place, and your project is a little corner of that. That's a dominant model in the biomedical sciences, frankly. And the thing is, your piece may be an important part of what's going to come in the future for that research group. And so they want to see this in the literature in order to move things forward. They need those results, or they need the proof out there, or they need people reading that information in order to move things forward. The second barrier, I would say, is misunderstandings and unclear expectations about authorship. Like I said, it's best to clarify ahead of time. I would say understand that circumstances can change. That, you know, and in the end, everyone should keep in mind that second author on a paper that appears sooner is better than first author on one that never appears at all. Just putting it out there. I can't tell you the number of people, even among, and I swear, if you went to see your professors, if we sort of lined us all up in front, all of the papers that we would have liked to have written, woulda, shoulda, coulda, that we would have liked to, and sometimes we want to hold on to these things, but if there is, it is much, much, much better to get published than not to get published, and sharing the work and the credit is an important part of getting published on an ongoing basis if you want to be an ongoing contributor to the literature. Writing with others. Every writer must come to terms with having to drop or change cherished sentences or paragraphs. Probably, with the exception of folks who have done undergraduate or graduate work with other research groups, you've all had the experience, I know, because I've been involved with one team, of drafts get submitted, changes, questions, this doesn't make sense, and so forth, and you're back and forth and back and forth. And eventually, it's good enough, and we move on. But you realize really quickly that writing for yourself and writing, you know, or writing course papers where you write a few drafts but you submit it, you get your feedback, thumbs up, thumbs down, thumbs sideways, that writing together for something that's going to be read by a large audience means that you really have to drop your pride about those phrases or those ideas that you thought were so fantastic. And in the end, sorry. Just no room for that. Or sorry, actually it's not that clear or not that intelligent or not that bright. What professional writers use, an expression that's not very politically correct, is that you have to be willing to kill your babies, that you have these precious sentences or paragraphs that you love, 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 and every single word has to stay exactly the same. But if you're actually going to move forward, especially as a writing team, you have to be willing to or scratch out sentences or whatever. That can be tough. That can be tough, and I can tell you that even when, if you decide to get into publishing and you're doing this for decades, it will still be tough sometimes to strike that sentence, that paragraph, to change that idea about what the message is, to admit that that introductory section that you worked on for months and months and months and months, or the one that you polished so much in order to get, you know, your ethics out the door, that we got to start over again and we got to rework it because the primary message is a different one. Questions of style and content are often easier for more senior writers to settle out, which is not to say that you can't be wrong, that your professors or your advisors can't be wrong about some things, but you need to think in terms of moving things forward and meeting deadlines. Sometimes saying, okay, you know what? If you think this is important, we're just going to do it. We're going to delete this. We're going to change this word. We're going to do whatever, instead of fighting out matters of style. At a certain point, you know, what I was told, actually, I wasn't told this personally. I was a witness to this, where somebody says, if your supervisor says mayonnaise, you don't say, I don't like mayonnaise. I like ketchup. You say Kraft or Hellman's. Writing with others means that you bend. That you bend and you accept the idea that in order to polish a message that you may need to change your approach. So there are multiple types of writing out there. At places like McGill, at the top of the mountain, we put the peer-reviewed journal article, the research article. But there are a lot of other places to put ideas in the world, to publish, to expose your ideas, to get practice with writing. What's gotten a bad rap in recent years, case studies and case series, where you talk about a particular patient or patients that you've worked with or whatever, and you develop ideas about what common themes might be. And I'm not talking case study methodology and qualitative research, not talking about that at all. I'm talking about clinical experiences with particular patients, with series of patients. Those, a good case study, can be of enormous usefulness to the field. And that's why journals like L'Infirmière du Québec, Canadian Nurse, and so forth, they still publish that stuff once in a while because it can be very useful. They're not easy to write, by the way. Clinically oriented articles, books, and so forth. You know, 10 things to know about liver enzymes, or, you know, new developments in the treatment of COPD or insulin-dependent diabetes or whatever. That you can write articles about the clinical management of something, or, you know, approaches and, you know, strategies for identifying strengths in patients or whatever it happens to be. Literature reviews and systematic literature reviews, another type of contribution to the literature. There was a time, and this is more like 20 years ago, where students were told when they worked on a 630, 631, 632 project, or especially if they were working on a PhD dissertation, publish your literature review. This is an amazing work. This is amazing work that you did, you know, sort of rounding up all this information, and you should publish your literature review because it's always better to publish than not to publish. And then what people started to realize is they submitted literature reviews that were basically copy and paste from a school paper or a big school paper on steroids. Journals didn't want to publish these for some reason or another. And that's because these literature reviews, in almost all cases, were sort of arguments building up to the specific research questions that you that you were going to address in a study, rather than a buildup of ideas and a synthesis of the literature that would serve the clinician looking for an answer to a specific question, or someone seeking to understand how the evidence on different sides fell with respect to a given set of phenomena or clinical questions or whatever. Literature reviews are extremely difficult articles to write well. Many journals now will not even consider an article that has a lit review feel unless it is a systematic literature review where you have very defined search parameters, databases, and selection criteria for articles, and you have at least at some point done a thorough, you know, synthesis table of evidence kind of approach, and so forth. But they are enormously useful to the field. A good literature review is like a gift to people who are working in the field. It's like you doing the legwork for someone in terms of understanding where they are. And even if your lit review ends at 2011, well, wow, that's up to 2011 done, and then I can just look for the stuff that comes afterwards. But it's another kind of writing. Analytical commentaries and essays, where, you know, you analyze a phenomenon. You're not necessarily trying to answer a question or say what the state of the literature is on an issue, but you're trying to discuss something. Trying to change identities of content of articles to protect the confidentiality of peer review. But let's say you want to talk about, you know, five important concepts with respect to the treatment of a vulnerable population or whatever, health services offered for a particular population, or important directions for research or education or clinical practice in nursing in a particular area. Well, you know, you can write that up. You can write that up in a systematic form, and you can come up with an argument that advocates for something or traces out an argument. That can be useful. Also, not easy kinds of articles to write, because all someone needs to do, just like your instructors when you write the course papers, is say, ah, that argument doesn't hold water. You didn't cite the right stuff, or, you know, your argument collapses on whatever point. Other ways to publish: letters to the editor. If you're reading journals out there, La Fermière du Québec, Canadian Nurse, but even some research journals, and you have feedback, you know what? I think the authors reached a conclusion that wasn't entirely correct, or you might not know that, you know, either congratulating the authors of an article for raising an important question, highlighting a new area, or critiquing or trying to add context. Sometimes people say this is a good way to get started in the literature. I'm not sure in terms of how much credit you get for this, but again, it's another form of putting your ideas out there. Book chapters. These are, and I'm sort of noted here, they're usually commissioned, because in most cases, books that nurses would publish in professionally, they would be the sort of collections, either in a textbook form, or they would be a collection of researched book-based book chapters on a given theme, and usually somebody comes to you to ask you to write one of these things up. For some reason or another, probably because of the nature of the peer review process and because they're usually commissioned, if you're looking in terms of the career value, not the monetary value, because, as I said, you can't get rich from doing peer review, writing in the peer-reviewed literature. Book chapters usually count for less. The kind of publication that really counts at places like McGill and its peers are research articles. And what you have to remember is that there's not only sort of what I would call the traditional around 3,000 word introduction methods, results, and discussion format. That's the classic. There's also what they call short articles and research briefs. Because sometimes the message you have isn't a big message. It's a little message. So sometimes it's better to deliver that message in a smaller format than really try to extend it into a 3,000-word format. Now, being really honest, given the nature of the projects that you guys have done, I think the target for most of you is going to be this 3,000-word format. In the biomedical sciences, sometimes, though, there's a lesson out of something that's relatively concise. The method is relatively easy to explain, and the finding is, you know, fairly circumscribed. But I have seen, no names mentioned to protect the innocent, in the course of my time as an editor, people writing a 3,000-word traditional research article format, and the finding was one Pearson product moment correlation. All this introduction, research question, all the methods, and one correlation. People do that sometimes, and some journals will take it, some won't. But we're going to talk, so keeping in mind, I'm not going to talk a lot about the details of the format, because you already know what a lit review is, what methods look like, what the components are, and so forth. But those are the formats. As I said, I've been working as a peer reviewer and a journal editor for a long time. A bunch of years ago, I wrote an editorial for Canadian, for CJNR, called The Four Main Reasons Manuscripts Get Rejected. Okay? And so this is, and it, obviously, it's a really painful thing. Nobody likes to say, nobody likes to hear, no thanks. So the four reasons, top reason: wrong material or approach for journal. Sometimes, because again, sometimes people are saying, I need an article on my CV, I need an article on my CV, or my supervisor won't get off my back until I submit something somewhere, so I just got to go out and I got to send the manuscript. And this is an article that's kind of about pain and symptom management, so I'm going to send it to Journal of Pain and Symptom Management. Not realizing Not having read the journal, and we'll come back to the way to fix this this problem before it even starts. You got to know what the journal is. And we're going to talk about the business of journal publishing. But journals usually have very specific missions in a number of cases. The kinds of material that they are seeking to publish, the kinds of audiences that they're seeking to address. So you're not going to submit an article about psychosocial aspects of ovarian cancer. You're not going to submit an article to Journal of Biological Chemistry. It just doesn't make any sense. But, you know, you're also, I mean, some of them are really obvious. Like, is it even the subject matter that the journal usually tackles? But what kind of a journal is this? Is this a journal that generally publishes big scale research? Is this a journal that publishes a mix of kinds of articles? What is the tone of the material that shows up in this journal? And I'll tell you, I'll give you sort of a personality profile of CJNR, so you can get a little bit of a sense of that. But leave it to say that L'Infirmière du Québec is different from the Canadian Nurse, is different from CJNR, is different from Nursing Research, is different from Heart and Lung, from American Journal of Critical Care, and so on and so on. Not looking and just like sort of going by the name of the journal or what you see some people do. You guys have all heard about impact factors, right? Getting the list of the top impact factor journals in a field, going to number one in the field that you think you're contributing to and submitting the manuscript. Let's take our shot, spin the wheel. We got to buy a lottery ticket if we want to have a chance to win. Submitting it and standing back, not successful. So, for instance, we don't publish clinical articles at CJNR, and I've gotten articles that were, 10 steps to safer medication administration. Total clinical article, no original data, non-analytical essay. I got to kick it back to the authors. Or people who submit research, but it's not formatted according to the journal guidelines in terms of introduction methods, results, and discussion. Got to kick it right back. Not the kind of material or the approach that we use. The second problem, the second reason, is too much rewriting needed, not close enough. So one of the big decisions that you make when you're about to submit an article is, have we polished it enough? And insider secrets, most journal editors and most peer reviewers, they like to have a little bit of a hand in the way your article will, assuming that the material's right, that the journal's the right choice, they'll want to have a little bit of a hand in the way that article winds up looking. They'll want to give you some feedback about what they want to see. They'll want to see some additions. They'll want to have a sense, rightly, sort of sometimes, and it's very legitimate, you forgot something, or there's an article or a literature that you're not aware of, or there's an important aspect of the methods that somebody really needs to know in order to understand whether your results were valid or try to replicate the work that you did. That's legitimate. But sometimes, it's psychology, right? Sometimes they just want to feel as if they had a chance to see if they could put a little of them in your article. Now, that being said, there are times when you read an article and the obvious stuff is spelling mistakes, problems with formatting, extensive problems with formatting. The journal says we follow APA 6th edition and it's formatted in an American Medical Association journal format and nothing's been changed, and instead of APA referencing, it's sort of the numbered footnote kind of approach to things, like things that are really not even close. Sometimes, if it's a matter of that well-written article and so forth, they'll give you some slack about some stuff. Sometimes they will look at the topic of an article, a journal, and peer reviewers will say, wow, this article needs a lot of work, but the message is so important and these authors have so much to say that we're going to cut them some slack, we're going to work with them, or we're going to turn it back to them and we're going to say, you need to go consult a statistician or you need to go consult a qualitative expert, but we like this article enough that we want to see it back. Sometimes, though, many journals don't have the time and the resources. CJNR, for instance, we're an entirely volunteer board, for instance, board of editors. And we have copy editors that we pay by the page. And so if something is riddled with grammar and spelling errors and isn't in the right format at all, we can't afford to do it because we don't have the staff on hand. The idea, and I'm going to show you a schematic of what the peer review process looks like. The general idea is, like I said, the editors and the peer reviewers, they want to feel as if they had a hand in your work. The idea is that most articles are accepted after one revision. If the peer reviewers and or the editor see that this is going to take more than one rewrite, generally they're going to say, just not close enough. And you want to not wait forever to submit your work, because it's always better to publish than not, right? Almost always. But at the same time, it needs to be polished enough so that a peer reviewer out in a field, and I'll tell you who peer reviewers usually are, and the editors can see that this is within one rewrite of being ready to be published. And you'd be surprised how much stuff is like, wow, this is a cool idea. Wow, this is really interesting stuff. But it's just not close enough, and there's no way we could turn it around, and we can't be in the weeds with these authors forever. They need to go somewhere else. The next, fatal errors in research design and or structural or factual weaknesses that make the conclusions potentially invalid. And this is basically, you just didn't do your homework, and you just didn't do a thorough enough lit review, and you didn't realize that somebody's actually published exactly the same thing the year before because your literature review wasn't thorough enough. Or you're drawing conclusions, you know, and you've now taken a few courses in research methods. You know that research articles, they make an argument starting from this is where the literature was, so these are the questions we want to ask, and this is the methods that we're going to use, these are the data we obtained, this is what you can and you can't conclude given the statistical tests or the analysis, the content analysis of the interviews or the materials, and these are the conclusions we can legitimately reach. Sometimes, especially authors working out on their own, and I would not say this is generally a problem with master's students and doctoral students, sometimes people don't realize that there are lots of other authors out there doing things and that there are standards or guidelines or understandings, conventions. I often use that word conventions, just understandings about the way things are done. That, for instance, if a good example, because I know you guys have gotten hammered on this over and over and over again through your education, measurement tools. Why it's important to not be making up measures willy-nilly, why it's important wherever possible to use measures with demonstrated reliability and validity, and or to make sure that you do some checks during your data collection around this. Someone who comes up with a paper and they draw really strong conclusions based on data that was collected using tools that were never validated, the psychometrics were never investigated, that can be a problem. That can be a problem, especially for a journal that likes to publish solid research. Sometimes in essays and arguments and research literature reviews, you will see that there are leaps in the conclusions that are made that just aren't warranted based on the data, that somebody along the line didn't quite check to make sure all of the wires in the circuit connected, and there are conclusions that really shouldn't have been reached that are just plain wrong. And that you can fix by working well with your team and getting some trusted opinions from outside the team before you go forward. The last one, and to me this is the saddest one, unclear, doubtful, or trivial contribution to the literature. So what? That business that I was talking about later. The purpose of this article is to help me insert another line in my CV and to get my supervisor off my back. You know? And I can tell you that now with the competition to get into the peer-reviewed press, there are journals out there, there are thousands, literally thousands, tens of thousands of journals out there. One of my grad school professors here at McGill 20 years ago said, if you have an article, there's a journal out there for you. And that's still true. There is a journal out there for you somewhere. So the question is it a journal that anybody can access? Is it a journal that anybody cares about? And is what you actually park there anything that you'd be proud of at all or that you try and hide under your vest that you'd pray that somebody looking at your CV wouldn't actually go and look up? This business about unclear, doubtful, or trivial contribution, you have to make. When you submit an article to the peer-reviewed literature for examination, for consideration, you kind of have to help the editorial staff and the peer reviewers fall in love, sentimental language, with your article. Why should we care? Why should I care? Why should I continue to read any further? How are these people saying something that's actually going to advance the discussion in some way. Sometimes confirming what's already out there in a new population, in a current setting, given changes in context, that can be good enough. That can be a contribution too. But why should we bother? Why should the reader bother? Why should the peer reviewers and the editorial process invest in this particular article? And you'd be amazed at the number of times where it's just not clear why people are publishing at all. And that's why I emphasized message at the beginning. You have to have a clear message or a small number of messages, and you gotta have people not need to dig for them. Because you can say, well, it's in there. Well, yeah, but you know, I had to read the article 3 times to actually know what it was that was of interest. No, it has to pop out. It has to be really clear. So, preemptive strike against rejection reasons number 1 and 2. Wrong journal and, what was number 2? Too much rewriting needed. Okay. Read the journal you're planning on submitting to. And you're going to laugh. But I know full professors, like people who have gone up the whole food chain in academia, who either they or their students submit to journals they actually don't read. And that's like that's a real problem sometimes, because sometimes you wind up submitting stuff that's absolutely out to lunch relative to what a journal usually publishes. Is this the kind of subject matter or approach that a journal tends to deal in or handle? And what have they published recently in this area? Certainly, if you're publishing sort of clinically oriented manuscripts, you're writing a paper on, you know, I don't know, new generation diabetic medication or whatever, and you're submitting to a journal that just published an article like that last year, the odds aren't good. In research, it's a little different because there are hot areas of research and are topics that people come around, and you always have something new to say, and I would in any study that you do. But it's important that you have a sense of what they published recently in the area, because I will tell you, in the era of impact factors, sometimes journals will be really annoyed if you submit a manuscript on a topic and there are papers that clearly connect to what you're talking about and you don't appear to have read them because none of them have been cited. You really need to have a sense, a little bit, and I'm not talking about devoting a month at a time of all of your free time to reading every single article that has shown up in this literature, in that particular journal. I'm talking about doing a little bit of homework though. You know, in terms of the personality, the style, and talking, and or talking to members of your research team and or others, including librarians sometimes, about where articles of your type usually show up. The other point, and this won't help you with grammar and style and so forth, but to read the submission guidelines for the journal for hints about topics and formats and so forth. I cannot tell you how many times we get articles when we say 20 pages maximum, including references, and we get 22 or 23 or 24, and it's... 20 is 20, you know, 20 is 20, and if you want to submit to us, it's 20, and if you want to submit somewhere else, we'll be very sad, but 20 is 20. Sometimes some of those guidelines get bent a little bit during the peer review process, but eventually we ask everybody to come back down to 20. Like I said, if there are really big problems with formatting and style and so forth, that won't work, but you can at least show that you've read the guidelines and that you're trying to play by the journal's rules. Fit is critical to publishing and presentation success. I put in presentation too because you guys are going to probably be thinking about submitting abstracts based on this work to professional conferences. And you got to know, again, who's interested in the kinds of ideas that you're putting out there and what slant or spin would be of interest, you know, that you might take the same research that you've done and go to the OIIQ's annual conference, go to Canadian Cardiovascular with it, go to another conference, and there might be slightly different titles, slightly different emphases, slightly different findings that you sort of bring out and you profile. So the fit of your article or abstract for a particular journal or conference. When an article comes into the office, the editorial offices of a journal, and now that's sometimes not even a physical office, it's an online site where we manage manuscripts. The first thing the staff and the editor do is they look at the title, they look at the format. Does this feel like an article that we would ever publish? Because does it fit or not? So you really need to get to know the places, plural, where people in the disciplines that you want to communicate your ideas to, where they sort of congregate, where they hang out, where the parties are held. And you need to pick the right venues for a particular project or presentation and slant to present it the right way. So it's really important to think about that. So for instance, CJNR is what we would call a general interest nursing research journal. So we publish in all the specialties across all the roles and so forth. We mostly present, mostly publish data-based articles, so research articles. But if you have something that's hyper-technical, that feels very, very biomedical and doesn't tie back to nursing practice and or theory in any discernible way, it's too hyper-specialized and not connected to the discipline, it's not going to be a good fit for us. There are some journals out there that will take almost anything, or at least consider almost anything that you submit, but most journals and conferences will look to see if the way you're presenting your topic and the way you're presenting it is going to reach their audience. Some thoughts about journals. And man, do people have ideas about this. So I'm going to put some ideas out there, and you can feel free to disagree. And now you guys are pretty astute consumers of journals. And you can probably tell me what your favorite ones and your less favorite ones are. What journals, when you see in your lit search that there's an article that's popping up in a journal, oh, that's going to be a good one, because they always publish good stuff, or the format's usually good. There are what's known as most respected articles, most respected journals, you know, sort of the prestigious journals. I've made it when I've published in X. There are high impact journals, and this is sort of an allusion to impact factors. The number of times an average article in that journal is cited by other journals. And you probably know that journals like Cell and Nature and Journal of the American Medical Association and New England Journal of Medicine, the average article is cited 30, 40, 50 times. And that the average nursing journal article is cited once in the peer review literature, sometimes twice in a 5-year period. So that's, you know, sort of another whole thing. We could spend 3 hours about high impact, but you need to know about that. And there are people who would say, if you can't, you know, like just like they'd say, well, if you can't get into McGill's master's program, you may as well not do a master's at all, because nothing else counts. And there are people who say, if you can't publish in JAMA or New England Journal or whatever, you may as well not publish at all. And I would tend not to take that stance. The most read journals by the individuals most likely to find your piece relevant, that's the other thing. To me, that's the sweet spot. Where people will look for your articles, where you will find the best fit. So there's some big distinctions out there. There are general interest nursing journals out there that mostly don't publish research, frankly. They may publish the occasional research article, but it's a rarity. It really is. So you guys, I'm sure, are very familiar with Nursing 2014. We're affectionately known as It's 12 O'Clock, Do You Know Where Your Patient Is? You know, sort of my patient and how I solved his problems. That kind of a journal that's a lot about clinical advice, advice columns and so forth. Canadian Nurse, La Famille du Québec, that generally focus on practice issues and developments in practice, and maybe occasionally a research article. But boy, that research article has to be in something hot, and it's, boy, you can't go too technical on stuff. They're not going to be interested in the philosophical underpinnings of your qualitative approach and whether you've been faithful to the traditions of phenomenology or whatever. There are specialty nursing journals that are kind of like the general interest ones, but focus on a particular clinical population or role, like Journal of Nursing Administration, for instance. That's a nursing administration journal specifically aimed at mid-level to executive-level nurse administrators, or Critical Care Nurse, which is a clinical journal, occasionally publishes research papers, but deals with the knowledge around the delivery and management of critical care nursing services. And they do a mix of research and other kinds of articles. There are a whole host out there of general interest nursing research journals, which I can tell you 20 years ago used to be what every good girl or boy wanted for their birthdays, was an article in one of these journals, because this was thought of as the place to contribute towards the emerging discipline of nursing. Nursing Research, a journal that's edited out of University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, used to be the most prestigious journal, that if you were hoping to launch your career and establish your legitimacy as a nurse scholar, you had to publish in Nursing Research sooner or later. I would say now, well, I'll come back to this, but now it's still a very good journal, But they publish articles in all in all the different Methodist traditions, all the clinical specialties related to all kinds of different roles. And the articles are still very good. And I'm kind of a friend slash acquaintance of the current editors there, and I do a lot of reviews for them. But there are lots of other places to publish. There's a journal called Research in Nursing and Health, which is published out of University of Rochester. There's Western Journal of Nursing Research, which is published out on the West Coast, and I don't know where for a while. It was at University of Alberta, the editorial offices, but I don't know where it is now. Another example would be CJNR, and I'm going to talk about that at the end today. But there are also a couple of British journals that are pretty good that publish in all different clinical areas called Journal of Advanced Nursing and Journal of Clinical Nursing. They have decent impact factors, sort of in the nursing zone. And they're selective. There's a little bit of prestige to them. But the kinds of research they publish is fairly broad. Another thing to keep in mind that, these are nursing journals we're talking about and broad categories. There's also interdisciplinary and medical specialty journals like, we could pull out Canadian Journal of Cardiology. Or Birth, and Birth is a very prestigious, high-impact journal that is cross-disciplinary, has a lot of nursing and midwifery articles, but very widely cited articles, but that do a mix of research and other content, too. So again, when you think about fit and who the audiences for your material would be, who would be interested, you need to think about the kind of journal that you love, that you like to publish in. I can tell you that if your supervisors, especially if they're capital R researchers who are, sort of on this path where they're every year they have a performance evaluation and how many articles they publish and how much money they've brought in is important, they might be very concerned about where you try to park your article. But in a lot of cases, it can be a mistake to just go after the most prestigious journal without thinking of whether that journal is a good fit. And sometimes a journal that doesn't have a very high impact factor or is not even a nursing journal might be, or are exclusively a nursing journal, can be a good place to put your results. So you should keep that in mind. I can tell you I've been reviewing articles often on health service, because I'm a health services researcher. I look at things like cost and quality and access to services and safety issues. I've reviewed quite a few articles for Journal of the American Medical Association over the years. A lot from nurses. And basically they see at the top of the general interest health journals, they see JAMA. The number of articles that get accepted at JAMA is about 5% or less. Very, very, very tough to get in there. So yes, it's like the gift. It's like the gift of the year, the birthday gift, to beat all birthday gifts if you get in there. But is it that those journals, New England Journal and JAMA, they are journals that the journalists read to know what's hot in health publishing. And their editorial offices are looking for not what articles people want to publish in a high prestige journal. They're looking for articles that are going to be of interest to as wide an audience, to physicians, nurses, health policy people, and the general public as possible. If you don't have a message in your results that could potentially appear in the newspaper, in a general press newspaper, in the Gazette on the health page, probably JAMA is not the journal for you unless you're making a huge discovery that revolutionizes healthcare. Again, people submit to journals and sometimes they really don't understand them and they shoot in the wrong directions. Now I will make a confession to you. I have never had an article out and out rejected. I've always gotten revise and resubmit for any article that I've submitted. One of my advisors along the way said, that's because you're not aiming high enough. You could be getting your articles into higher impact, more prestigious journals if you'd only aim higher and you were prepared to accept rejection more often. You know what? It's an approach. It's an approach. I know a lot of people. I know people in the scientific community here in Montreal and in other places. They say we go to the top first, regardless of whether our message is all that new. Others say, you know what? We need to get articles out now. We need to get them into the hands of people who can use them to develop their practice or develop future articles. Anyway, okay, we're going to do a little more and then we'll take a break. General writing advice. Okay, so I was saying, number one problem in getting an article together is that failure to launch. We never get a full first draft together to work from. And I think one of the best pieces of writing advice I've ever heard is to take things bit by bit. Or there's this great book, I have to say, if you ever have any plans of writing, whether scientific articles, doing creative writing, if you're going to write your autobiography, your memoirs, or whatever, if you're going to write the greatest novel of all time, there's this great author. She doesn't write science, but she writes nonfiction essays and fiction. Her name is Anne Lamott. Her book is called Bird by Bird. And basically, she talks about if you have this task and it just seems so big, break it down into its pieces and take them one by one. And I won't mangle the anecdote that leads to the title, but that business of, you know, I figured out what my message for my paper is going to be out of my 632 project, and now I got to write it up. Okay, I'm going to try to write the introduction now. And today, you know what? If I can get all the way through a first draft of the introduction, great, but I just want to write the first paragraph of that explains the literature that led to my study. Just start bit by bit. If you make steady progress towards things. Or I'm going to write the section about my instruments. That's always easy to do because you can't make it up, right? It's there. You have the information. You can transfer it and you can edit it a little bit. But basically, you go systematically until you've covered each piece that you need to string together. Another suggestion, I was saying that presentations are a great way to hone your thinking and to get ready to write an article. Absolutely. But one of the mistakes that we make, young writers, experienced writers, is sometimes we talk about what we're doing. We talk, I got this great idea for an article, and they talk and they get some feedback, but the problem is they keep talking it even after it's time to get down and sit and write with the keyboard and put it down. And you gotta get them down on paper. Get them down electronically. It's not paper anymore. See, I'm dating myself. It's really, really important to get something down that you can then work from, if only to say, okay, this is really bad, but at least I know it's not this. And it's a start. And this and this and this that I can keep, but this I can modify. Perfectionism, the last point here, perfectionism is the biggest barrier. Wanting your prose of your article, and you've seen this with papers now because you're all experienced students, wanting not to waste lots of time in redrafting and hoping if you wait long enough, it will tumble from your fingers in perfectly formed prose that's beautifully organized. No, not going to work. You have to give yourself permission to write really terrible first drafts. That's the deal. Get it down. At least then it's something to work from and to say, not that. But then you got to fix them. Because sometimes what you see, and again, young writers, really experienced writers, sometimes their supervisor said to them, you know, we got to submit by August 31st or whatever because of whatever reason, real reason, made up reason. And August 29th, they start to sit down, they're pounding on the keyboard on August 30th, and then it's done, and there's something that looks like an article. And bang, they send it out the door to the journal to consider, and they have the peer reviewers work it out. Ah, if it's close enough, the peer reviewers will do something with it. No. You write a really great or really terrible first draft, but then you gotta fix it. And it gets easier over time. The willingness to modify your precious phrases, paragraphs, and so forth, it gets easier. I remember the first times when I submitted papers, chapters, and so forth, and I was devastated at the critique. And when I'd see the red line slashing out, or, you know, fix in great big red letters, I was, you know, sort of devastated. But one of the things that you realize over time, that drafting good stuff and then getting published, it's about taking the feedback and not taking it too much to heart. I once heard somebody say, if you want pats on the head, warm fuzzies, get a dog. Don't go into peer-reviewed publishing. Because basically, it's a dialogue where people are trying to get closer to better patient care, better understandings of things. And it's only through a little bit of roughness, unnecessary roughness sometimes, from your supervisors, from your peers, from the anonymous peer review process, that you can actually get to a better point. Okay? Questions, thoughts about what we have so far? Any of this totally alien?
I have a question.
Sure. There's no stupid questions. There really are none. There really are none.
The approach that we chose to go with my group, my advisor for this project, is submit we kind of went for a paper, and then we Mm-hmm. And we kind of made a list, like from 1 to 10, mm-hmm. our number one target mm-hmm. to the one that like, we're desperate. So that's how we did it. And we're like, okay, we're going to send 3 abstracts to the first 3 editor and then mm-hmm.
A. Okay.
And then C. We got okay. rejected yesterday, the first one.
Okay. Not our cup of tea, not what we do, or not in its current form.
Exactly. You told us, like, maybe you could try to set it up, you know? Like, it
yep.
kind of,
yeah.
They wrote it nicely, but
yep.
that's what the result. So I'm just thinking, is there an advice that you would give me?
Okay. Okay. This is a great question. So you're getting at a few things. One of them is, in the process of looking for a home for your manuscript, instead of waiting to have a whole manuscript that's all been prepared and polished, to go throw out a query email, a question email to the journal editor or the journal staff and say, I got this, would you be interested in seeing this? And I can tell you that about 90%, not a scientific number, not willing to consider that an evidence-based statistic, but about 90% of journals will come back and they'll give you an answer one way or another. They will say, I got to see the paper, you know, to make a firm decision. They'll say, I got to see the paper. We have to go through peer review and so forth. And you just say, okay, yeah, I understand your peer review journal. That's how you have to do things. But they will often come back and say, ah, that's not the kind of thing we tend to publish, or we just published something in that area, or, you know, just given the parameters of what you're telling us about, the odds that we would ever accept an article like that are really slim, so you can look elsewhere. You will find it will happen at least once if you sort of pursue publishing, that whether or not you do a query email to a journal first, you think that you've read the author guidelines, you think you understand the journal and what they publish, you send it in, and not quite 18 minutes later, but maybe 2 hours later, you get back, reject without review. And basically that's the editor saying, for either a clearly defined reason, like not the kind of subject matter we handle, not the format, not in a format that we tend to use, or whatever, sometimes it's just not a good fit for us at this time, which is not particularly happy, but you know, it's better to be told up front. They are actually doing you a favor. Because often they will have a sense of whether you're playing in the right league, to use a sports metaphor. If your article, which is probably fantastic for a journal that's the right fit, it's just not going to survive well through the process. It's just really, and they feel more comfortable sending your article, if you would send your article to a journal that has a better chance of your article finding a home. I get the grammar there all mixed up. The whole idea for them and for you is that you get your article in a good home sooner versus later. The editors now, I mean, it depends on the journal, you know, how many articles get submitted and how many get accepted and so forth. I can tell you, JAMA, for instance, because it's such a high-profile venue, they get 2,000 to 3,000 submissions a year. And often they will kick things out right at the initial stage, just not clear, you know, and they'll get rid of the next whack of them at the peer review stage when they look at whether how tight the conclusions are and whether it has general medical interest. Even journals, though, because we used to be the safety journal for folks, you know, sort of down at the bottom. If we can't get into all these other journals, we'll go to CJNR. We are getting, let's say, 10 to 20 articles submitted a month. And we end up accepting about 20% of them. And peer review, your time, and I'm going to explain the peer review process, is precious. We don't like to annoy our peer reviewers with stuff that's just not ready. So we try to triage up front as much as possible. To be as delicate as possible about it. So I would totally recommend that approach, sitting down with your team, coming up the list, and sending query emails, great move. Even when you do that, sometimes you'll get rejected right out the gate, but it does save time in a lot of ways. Okay. Other questions? Have you found journals that, like, when you see the journal pop up as in your lit searches, like, that, wow, you think, wow, this is going to be, like, this is probably going to be a pretty good article? Does that happen? I like this journal. I like the stuff that shows up in it. Yeah. And that's pretty cool when you're a journal that's known as a go-to journal about on a particular topic or topics. Okay. Other questions about this material so far? Have I scared you? I don't want to scare you. I'm not trying to scare you, really. These are things I wished I had known in some ways, but I did okay even without knowing them. Okay, well, why don't we take a break for 10? 10? Is 10 okay? It is 10:05. 10:04. Okay, so we'll come back at quarter after? Quarter after. Okay, thanks.